Quick disclaimer, information in this podcast is for general informational purposes only and is not intended to be treated as medical advice. Always consult with your healthcare team before making changes to your diet, lifestyle, supplementation, or medication.
While many people assume they will lose weight by restricting calories this low, it really comes along with lots of negatives. For instance, difficulties in sticking with the low calorie intake longer term, hunger, potential nutritional deficiencies, metabolic slowdown, muscle loss, and negative effects on energy levels and mood.
Welcome to Type 2 Diabetes Talk, the place where we chat about what really works to treat type 2 diabetes and prediabetes naturally with nutrition and lifestyle. If you're looking to optimize blood sugar and A1C, lose weight, reduce medications, and improve your overall health, this is the place to be. Now, here's your host, type 2 diabetes nutrition specialist, Dr. Jetta.
Hello, wonderful people. Dr. Jetta here, and thanks for tuning in to episode 23. Today, we're diving into a Q&A session, and to help me with today's chat, I'd like to welcome back Emily. Hello, Emily.
Hello, Jetta. Great to be back to tackle some more questions from our listeners and subscribers.
It is great to be back for another Q&A because our last one was a few months ago. And it's always surprising how fast time flies. So if you're listening, thanks for spending your precious time with us. And I hope we are making a real difference in your life, helping you to improve your diabetes health. I do love these Q&A sessions because we are answering the questions or covering the topics submitted by you. So if you have a question, be sure to head down to our website at type2diabetestalk.com to leave us a voice message or email, and we will cover it in a future Q&A session. And Emily, we've got a lot of great questions to cover today, right?
Yes, so many great topics. We're going to cover areas of blood sugar monitoring, recapping numbers, looking at strange effects of some food, gluten-free foods, ice cream, blood type diets, muscle pain, macronutrient ratios, and more. There really is some pretty good grounds to explore today.
Wow, that does sound like a great variety we've got to cover today. So shall we get started with the first question?
Yes, let's get started.
Okay, well, we'll start with this question for you, Emily. Pam asked, if I choose not to go on medicine, do I still have to check my A1C every week or two? How would I do that if I do not use strips or anything?
Thanks for the question, Pam, and good for you for choosing not to go on medication. Let's start by clarifying the difference between testing your blood sugar, which is often done at home on a regular basis, daily for many people, or sometimes weekly, depending. Whereas A1C, on the other hand, is a blood test ordered by your doctor and done through a pathology lab every 3 months or so. If you choose not to go on medicine, you don't necessarily have to monitor your levels, but here's two things I would say. First, it definitely is recommended to have your regular checkups with your doctor. Periodically, every 3 to 6 months is ideal. And if you've chosen not to take meds and you're at the beginning of this journey, I'd really recommend every 3 months is best. Your doctor will usually check your A1C to see how your blood sugar is tracking, so this can give you information on what to do moving forward. As for checking your blood sugar levels at home, you do need a monitor along with lancets and strips, or a continuous glucose monitor. We do recommend monitoring is a good thing to do because it gives you immediate feedback about how you're tracking and helps you understand so much about whether you need to make adjustments with your daily nutrition intake and your day-to-day lifestyle routine. Anything else to add to that, Jetta?
Nope, you covered it perfectly, Emily, and definitely your A1C should be tested every 3 to 6 months regardless, I think, and whether to monitor daily using a monitor and strips is a choice, but as Emily said, we definitely recommend it, especially if managing diabetes is a new journey for you or your blood sugar levels aren't yet in an ideal range.
I 100% agree. And I think we can move on to our next question now, which is from Julie. And Julie asks, I would like to know if gluten-free foods are generally low carb. My daughter has just been diagnosed and needs to eat gluten-free, and we found we can both eat gluten-free cereal and gluten-free tacos, but apparently gluten-free bread is not low carb. Some guidance here would be great.
Excellent. Yes, gluten-free. We do need a whole episode on this, so we'll certainly plan one in future. But these are great questions, Julie, because many people automatically think that following a gluten-free diet's better, and they get confused about whether gluten-free automatically means low carb. So to answer your question directly, gluten-free foods are not generally low carb. In fact, it can be quite the opposite. Many gluten-free foods can be some of the highest carb foods. The difference with the gluten-free products is the type of flour that is used in them. So instead of that wheat flour, a gluten-free product might use potato, corn, tapioca, or rice flours. And these flours are all high in carbs, more than many of the gluten-containing flours. And unfortunately, many gluten-free foods, they also lack fiber. And you're right, Julie, gluten-free breads are definitely not low carb. Gluten-free breads generally, they are similar to many regular breads in terms of their carbs. For example, two slices is 30 grams, one slice 15 grams. And with that many carbs, you'd stick to just one slice, that's for sure. And unfortunately, it can be pretty difficult to find store-bought gluten-free low-carb breads. But I guess I want to emphasize, like, just because you can't get the breads and some of the products, that doesn't mean following a gluten-free diet is harder with diabetes. Not at all, because we encourage a gluten-free diet pretty much. At least 95% of all the recipes and meal plans in our sites are gluten-free. And that's because we encourage you to dramatically reduce those grain-based foods due to their high carb content. And so I think you might be one of our members, Julian. There are over 30 bread recipes inside the members site, really easy ones too. So check one of those out for your daughter, but definitely do be careful with those gluten-free products. Always read the food labels for the carb amounts and refer to our recommended food list for more guidance on this too. All right, well, I hope that answers the question. And we've got a question now from Edabom asked, so much has been said about diabetics eating peanut and peanut butter. When I eat peanuts, my blood sugar spikes. I keep wondering why. Because of this, I don't want to take peanut butter till I have a reasonable answer.
Edabom, you've touched on a really fascinating aspect of diabetes management and nutrition. It's interesting because peanuts and peanut butter are often recommended as part of a diabetic-friendly diet due to their low-carb, healthy fat, and protein content, which, in theory, should help stabilize blood sugar levels and isn't a problem for most people. But as you've noticed with peanuts in your own situation, not all foods are always straightforward.
So true, Emily. Everyone has to be in tune with their own situation, their own body. So what should Edabom consider then?
A good question to start with is, are you sure it's the peanuts and not something else? For example, what else is being consumed around the same time? If the peanuts are eaten alongside other carbohydrate-containing foods or snacks, the combined effect might lead to a noticeable spike in your blood sugar. You'd have to test the effect of peanuts and only peanuts 2 hours after eating them to see the effect. So if you haven't done that yet, I'd recommend starting there.
Exactly. If you want to test the effect of a food on your individual blood sugar results, test the food in solo 2 hours after you eat it, and you'll soon be able to identify foods that do and don't work for you and your specific situation. Because with any food, there can be individual variability with those foods, right, Emily?
Right. Everyone's body responds differently to different foods. So there will be cases like this where it's an odd one, a food that is affecting you, which by all means shouldn't, because in most cases, it's a recommended food.
Right. And why would we see this happen?
For any food, this could occur for a number of reasons. For example, with peanuts, it could even be a mild peanut allergy causing an inflammatory reaction that influences blood sugar. That's certainly a possibility. Peanuts for you may just be a food you need to avoid. And certainly, if you are reacting to peanuts, you don't want to eat peanut butter because it's likely to have the same outcome.
Definitely. Make sure you listen to your own body. That's very important when it comes to these things.
Very true. Let's move on to our next question, which is from Juliet. And Juliet asks, do diabetics have to follow blood type to choose their meals?
Interesting question, Juliet. And the answer is a plain no. People with diabetes don't need a special diet dependent on their blood type. And there was a book released years ago called Eat Right for Your Type. And that perhaps is where it came from because it sold millions of copies around the globe. And I read that book years ago too. But the thing is, in terms of the scientific evidence, there is none that exists to validate any health benefits of blood type diets. I don't know about you, Emily. Did you ever read that book?
I did read the book, and you're right that quite a few years ago, it was very popular. I think a lot of people were sold by what they were promising. But as you already mentioned, the science just isn't there, and there's definitely better ways to eat for your diabetes management.
Yeah, I did dive into the evidence again just to make sure, but there literally is none that exists to validate any of those health benefits. So,
fortunately, that's quite common with lots of nutrition recommendations and different organizations, which is why you and I were always looking at the science and trying to stay up to date. And I think we do a good job with that.
Yes, absolutely. Evidence over opinion is one of our core values. So I'd say go back and listen to episode 6, Juliet, where we covered what to eat to treat diabetes, as it lays down the foundations of what you'll need to eat to improve your diabetes health and get great results. So I've got a question now for you, Emily, from Sherry, and she asked, I have Leber too, and I wonder which is the safest, highest number of a reading after a meal and after a night's sleep, and when after a meal are the best times to check the readings?
Such a great question, Sherry. So lots of sites like the American Diabetes Association will say that for people with type 2 diabetes, 180 milligrams per deciliter or 10 millimoles per liter are the safest, highest number of a reading after a meal. This is called postprandial blood sugar. And this level's okay, but ideally you want to aim for a level under 140 milligrams per deciliter or under 7.8 millimoles per liter, because we know this is considered the normal healthy range and is associated with the least risk for diabetes complications. With prediabetes, the same is true. A level under 140 milligrams per deciliter or 7.8 millimoles per liter is best after meals. As for after a night's sleep, we're talking about your fasting blood sugar levels. The ideal here is under 100 milligrams per deciliter or under 6 millimoles per liter. For people with type 2 diabetes, up to 130 milligrams per deciliter fasting or 7.2 millimoles per liter might be more realistic for some people.
That's right. Morning levels can be a bit more challenging for some people. And Emily, the second part of Sherry's question was, when is the best time to check readings after a meal?
After meals, you want to check 2 hours after. So set a timer from your first bite of food and then check when your alarm rings 2 hours later. Definitely refer back to episode 11 to Sherry because it covers normal blood sugar ranges and goals in more detail.
Yeah, exactly. Episode 11 was really full of that stuff, Sherry, and all about the blood sugar levels and goals. So definitely head back and listen to that episode.
Get proven, practical support to lower blood sugar, weight, and medication. Check out Dr. Jetta's programs and services at type2diabetestalk.com/programs.
Our next question is from Brenda. Brenda asks, can you break down how many carbs, protein, fat grams for a 1,200 calorie a day for type 2s? I just started using a food diary, but the recommendations seem a little high for type 2. I'm reading that 70 carbs might be good, but just want to make sure that is accurate for a 1,200 calorie meal plan, plus what the protein fat requirements are as well.
Okay, interesting question. And firstly, I think I'd like to propose a question back to you, Brenda, just something to think about, is why do you want to lower your calories to 1200 a day? Is it because you want to lose weight? Most likely. But 1200 calories is a low calorie intake. And while many people assume they will lose weight by restricting calories this low, it really comes along with lots of negatives. For instance, difficulties in sticking with the low calorie intake longer term, hunger, potential nutritional deficiencies, metabolic slowdown, muscle loss, and negative effects on energy levels and mood. Yeah, and so to lose weight, you don't need to necessarily reduce calories. This is a common way of thinking, but please listen to episode 7 where Wilma talked about her effortless weight loss and she wasn't restricting calories. And also episode 12, where we talked about smart, sustainable weight loss, because it really gives you a much better approach to take if weight loss is your goal. And then as for the amount of carbs, 70 grams places you at the higher range of carbs for a 1200 calorie a day intake. So an amount of 30 to 77 grams would be appropriate in the context of 1200 calories. As for protein, you want a range of about 60 to 90 grams, which is a higher protein intake of 20 to 30%. And then fat would make up the remainder. So that's going to vary between about 73 to 93 grams. Like I said, though, I'd really consider what the purpose of reducing your calories so low is and whether it's actually worthwhile given all the potential negatives. Because most importantly, what we always say is if you can't sustain an eating plan longer term, that's really the main consideration too, because any gains you could potentially achieve could all be lost once you find it too difficult to stick to. And that's just some things to think about.
Yes, I agree with everything that you just said, and I would recommend the same thing. 1200 calories probably is a little low for most people. It depends on a variety of factors, but really think about it before moving forward with that plan.
Okay, the next question is from Christy. Christy asked, if I decide to eat about a cup and a half of ice cream, but then exercise for 20 minutes soon afterwards, will it still mess up my blood sugar?
Well, if you decide to have about a cup and a half of ice cream and then engage in exercise for about 20 minutes shortly after, you've definitely got a better chance of mitigating some of the potential blood sugar spikes that could occur. Exercise is a powerful tool for managing blood sugar because it helps move glucose out of the bloodstream and into your muscles where it's used for energy. So yes, exercise could lower the rise in blood sugar that might come from a sweet treat. But here's a key point to remember. While this strategy of exercising after indulging can help, it might not completely neutralize the blood sugar impact. You're only going to know how foods affect you by testing with a monitor. Something else to consider is that while enjoying your ice cream and then hitting a 20-minute workout is a positive step, it's probably not an ideal strategy to use all the time, because it undermines the broader picture and the impact that a healthy eating plan without sugary sweets like ice cream can have for your diabetes health.
Yes, definitely good points. Exercise can certainly help lower blood sugar. We know that, and it can be useful after a meal, that's for sure too. But I'm not sure I'd get into the habit of using that as a strategy to indulge too often. I just don't think it's probably such a positive strategy to use all the time.
Nope, I agree. In our diet, we always want to focus the highest percentage of what we're eating on healthy fats and protein and lots of fiber-rich vegetables and really limiting those sugary sweets like ice cream.
Yep, definitely. Focus on eating nutrient-dense foods because those are the types of foods that provide us with the most value.
Moving to our next question, Jetta, submitted by Elaine, who said, I use a food tracker and would like to control my daily intake of carbs, fats, and protein. What is a good daily ratio of carbs, protein, and fat for ultimate control of daily intake of food?
So as I've spoken about many, many times, we encourage a lower carb range because an abundance of research, including research I've conducted, show this range achieves the best results and it is sustainable too. We would recommend a maximum of 20% of total daily calories for carbs. So between 10 and 20% is great. For protein, you would aim a little higher for your protein intake as recommended, of around 20 to 30% of your total daily calories. And then fat will make up the remaining calories. So let's just put this in the context of if you're eating 2000 calories a day. Our recommendation is staying between that 10 to 20% carbs, so 50 to 100 grams of carbs per day. And then protein would be in the range of 100 to 150 grams per day. And fat would be in the range of 111 to 155 grams per day. Those ranges, that 10 to 20% carbs, that 20 to 30% protein, if you can get your protein up that to that little higher range, this provides people with a really flexible range of intake that's sustainable, which is always important, as we've said earlier. So we have one final question for today from Joyce. Joyce asked, what is the ideal reading for an 81-year-old person type 2? I get different readings. High is 160.
Joyce, thanks for reaching out with your question. The American Diabetes Association provides general guidelines with a target of less than 180 milligrams per deciliter or 10 millimoles per liter 2 hours after starting a meal. But for everyone, if achievable, as we shared in relation to Sherry's question earlier, ideally you want to aim for a level under 140 milligrams per deciliter or 7.8 millimoles per liter, because we know this is considered the normal, healthy range and is associated with the least risk for diabetes complications. So with that in mind, your level of 160 is still okay. It's within the ADA's range, but if you could work towards keeping it under that 140 milligrams per deciliter or 7.8 millimoles per liter, your A1C and overall health is going to be better too.
Yep, that's right. And just to point out, Joyce, it's normal to get different readings. Blood sugar levels can fluctuate daily because they can be influenced by lots of different things, such as the food we eat, exercise, stress, sleep, and other factors too.
Absolutely. So the key with monitoring is just to keep an eye on those patterns over time. And if you are monitoring, aiming for those ideal ranges most of the time, or identifying what's caused high levels if you are above range, is key to getting better health outcomes.
Yes, it certainly is. Well, that concludes today's Q&A session. Thanks for joining me again, Emily.
Thank you, Jetta, and thanks to everyone for sending in your questions.
Yes, thanks, everyone. There will be more Q&A sessions in future, so please do head to the website at type2diabetestalk.com and submit a voice message or email. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Have you ever wondered whether diabetes remission is a real thing, or what diabetes remission even means or involves? That's what we're looking into closely in the next episode. So please tune in next week. Take care for now. Dr. Jetta, over and out.
Thanks for tuning in to Type 2 Diabetes Talk. Please subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform. And for episode replays, episode notes, and more, visit type2diabetestalk.com. New episodes are available Tuesdays, 10 a.m. U.S. Eastern Time, or your time zone equivalent. Thanks again. We're truly grateful to be a part of your life and help make a real difference.